Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. Culture on the agenda in the Vatican this week as the plenary assembly of the Pontifical Council for Culture met from the 6th to the 8th to discuss the theme, the Church and the Challenge of Secularization. At the end of three-day meetings, peppered with talks and discussions, this highly cultured group of people, among whom bishops and cardinals, led by their president, Archbishop Gianfranco Ravasi, who recently took over the leadership of this council from Cardinal Paul Poupart, met with Pope Benedict XVI in the Vatican's stunning Clementine Hall. The Holy Father began by congratulating them on the choice of the theme chosen, remarking how it represents a fundamental issue for humanity and the Church.
Congratulandomi per il lavoro che svolgete, in particolare per il tema scelto per questa sessione.
And he ended by inviting those present and all pastors to work generously and tirelessly towards creating constructive dialogue between different cultures by announcing the gospel and bringing witness in an effort to contrast the worrying trend of secularization in society, which weakens the person and impedes the natural desire towards truth. May you, through the Council's work, the Pope went on to say, continue to announce Christ at the heart of cultures, because it is He who is the beacon of light which illuminates reason, humanity, and the world. Earlier on in his address, Pope Benedict had highlighted how the much reiterated death of God in recent decades by many intellectuals has been replaced by a sterile cult of the individual, which can only lead to a withered spirituality and an emptiness of heart, marked sometimes by surrogate forms of religiosity and vague spiritualism.
Di appartenenza religiosa e di vago spiritualismo.
The Holy Father also touched on the effects of globalization, how this has triggered and accelerated the spreading of Western materialism and individualism across the world, a way of living which has its roots in a sort of arrogance of reason, which considers itself as self-sufficient and closed to contemplation and research of a truth that reaches far beyond it. Great, he stressed, are the ensuing challenges the mission of the Church has to tackle in the light of this. And ever more important is the commitment of the Pontifical Council for Culture in engaging in a fertile dialogue between science and faith. Among those attending the audience with Pope Benedict was one of the relators at the Pontifical Council for Culture's plenary assembly. He's the Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn, Mark Benedict Coleridge, whose talk had the intriguing title of Are the New Forms of Religiosity an Indication of Post-Secularisation? On Saturday, Archbishop Coleridge took the trouble to join me in our studios here. I began by asking him to clarify the terminology of his talk on post-secularization. Let's listen. Archbishop Coleridge, you talk about post-secularization. But why don't we define secularization first?
Well, that's more difficult than it sounds, and that's one of the things that's emerging through this plenary assembly, that the whole phenomenon of secularization and the ideology to which it gives birth, which is called secularism, have roots that go deep and in many directions historically. The other thing is the phenomenon of secularization, which is now ubiquitous, largely because of globalization, but it takes very different forms in different cultures. And at the plenary assembly, you hear bishops and others speaking from Latin America, from North America, from Europe, from my part of the world, Australia, from Africa. And everyone speaks with different accents about the phenomenon of secularization. So it's a universal phenomenon whereby God is, as it were, no longer necessary, that the human being is in charge of the world and we are left to ourselves to make the great decisions that affect human life and death. So it's the sense of a world that has taken its leave of God and certainly of an institution like the church, which is regarded in many ways as being an antagonist, an enemy of progress and reason that drives progress, all those things that are associated with the secular world. So in the plenary assembly, we've been trying to explore the phenomenon of secularisation, first of all, to explore the ideology of secularism, which tends to be an aggressive offshoot of secularisation, and then also to try and work out, well, how might we respond to it? Because clearly it's not enough just to sit back and wring our hands and say, well, isn't it terrible or the world's going to ruin? I mean, that's not the Catholic way to turn our back on culture or on the world. So we are trying to identify a notoriously difficult and large phenomenon like secularisation, and we are seeking to imagine and discuss various ways in which the church can respond.
So what's post-secularisation? Is it a phenomenon that's typical of Australia? Or?
No, I don't think so. I think that there are signs of a kind of exhaustion, really, in various cultures around the world, certainly in the West, because secularism, at least, the ideology of the secular world, in the end offers a one-dimensional account of the human being. It doesn't satisfy the human heart, so that there tends to be a range of reactions to that one-dimensional secular account of the world, and you see it both in the church and beyond. New Age spirituality is a classic case. Another one of them that we discussed at great length is the phenomenon of religious sects in a place like Latin America. In part, they are a reaction to a one-dimensional secular account of human experience and human society. So that in various parts of the world, there are these emergent religious impulses. In other words, people want more. They're reaching out for what we might call the transcendent, and they're looking for something that satisfies the human heart. Now, some of these things I would regard as being dark and potentially destructive. Other things, less so. They can be deeply creative. But the human being needs more than a one-dimensional secular account of human experience. I mean, I think the evidence of that is everywhere. And there are signs of this religious impulse breaking out in new ways, both in the church and beyond.
What's wrong with the past, then?
Nothing wrong with the past. The past did many things well, but we can't just repeat the past. In other words, we have to look for new ways in which to foster the religious impulse. And that was one of the main things John Paul II was on about when he spoke of the need for a new evangelization. But one of the things that's becoming very clear in our discussions at this plenary assembly is that you can have all these forms of religiosity, but unless they lead to the person of Jesus Christ, they're not going to lead to anything that might be considered post-secular. What we are seeking is a kind of new enchantment, because a purely secular account of human experience leads to a sense of disenchantment. In other words, an enchanted world suddenly becomes dark and empty. And what the human being needs is a new kind of enchantment, which is another way of talking about the new evangelization. But if it's an enchantment without Jesus Christ and the encounter with him, then it's just hocus pocus. It's a kind of magic that in the end won't deliver what it promises.
So what you're fostering is the right religiosity here?
Well, I think so. I mean, I would like to think that that's one of the major tasks of the church.
How do you sow the seed of that kind of religiosity in contemporary society?
Well, first of all, you open the riches that the church has to offer. You don't have to go elsewhere. I mean, we've got ashrams and God knows what else full of former Catholics. What the church is very good at is stirring the desire for the supernatural. We're not always good at satisfying the quest that we stir. And that's why a lot of Catholics have to go elsewhere. But in fact, in the treasures of the church, we've got the whole mystical tradition, we've got the great riches of Scripture, we've got the teachings of the church embodied in a thing like the Catechism, but we need to find new ways, and this is what we're exploring. We can't just put up a sign saying business as usual. We have to find new ways of offering people that which they have every right to seek. And so that's what we're exploring, new ways, new strategies in which we can open to people the riches that the church has and do that in a way that satisfy the religious longings and the kind of seeking that, that so many people are engaged in at the moment. St. Augustine once described sin, that's the best definition of sin I've ever heard, as looking for the right thing in the wrong place. And what we are trying to do is to help people to find the right thing in the right place. In other words, a fuller sense of life. I mean, people speak about the human being as a being distinguished by the search for meaning. I'm not sure that that's true. I think what the human being is most distinguished by is a search for a kind of ecstasy. Now, the question is, where can it be found? I mean, we do search for meaning, but we want more, the search to be taken out of ourselves and experience a kind of ecstasy. And it's ironic that we have a little chemical pill called ecstasy, which, again, is seeking to offer a chemical solution to spiritual problems, which has never worked. So what we're saying is, yeah, look for ecstasy, but look for it in the right place. And in the end, the ecstasy is found in the encounter with the risen Christ. That's Christianity.
Does popular religiosity, popular piety, all things like pilgrimages, and does it appeal to people today?
I think it appeals enormously, and especially to the young.
But that's more along the line of the ecstasy that you were talking about.
Yeah, but if you look at it, pilgrimage has made a huge comeback. Even as I speak, my own auxiliary bishop is on the road to Compostela, and he wouldn't be the only one doing that. The whole El Camino, as they say, you know, the great pilgrimage route to Compostela in Spain, has made a huge comeback in recent times. World Youth Day. In my own diocese, we've just had the World Youth Day cross and icon going the length and breadth of the diocese, and that was an extraordinary experience because it's popular religiosity. The cross and the icon couldn't be simpler, but everywhere it went, people turned out in their droves, young and old, all kinds of people, just to touch the cross and the icon, and many of them were deeply moved by that. And you have to ask why. It puzzled a lot of people in a very secularised society like Australia. But there they were, all kinds of people from all walks of life, deeply moved by something as simple as the cross and the icon. So you've got a thing like that. World Youth Day is an experience of pilgrimage. You've got the whole resurgence of Marian piety, I guess, focusing on places like Medjugorje. I haven't been there myself, but many have, and it's a powerful experience for them. You've also got resurgence of Eucharistic adoration. Again, it's important to ask, why is that so? And I think one of the things is that at a time when the incarnation is denied or seems incredible, you know, that God could take flesh, here you have a devotional practice, to call it that, which is a powerful affirmation of the incarnation. The French writer Charles Péguy said years ago now that the denial of the incarnation is, he called it in French, un désastre mystique, a mystical disaster. And what he meant by that was that people think these days that to find their way to God, they have to deny their humanity. Or to take possession of their humanity in its fullness, they have to deny God. But what the incarnation says, in fact, is that there's a mysticism of the flesh. In other words, it's in possessing your true humanity that you find your way to God. Now, that's a complex statement that I've just made, but it's a statement that's made every time someone kneels or sits or lies or stands before the Blessed Sacrament. So a thing as simple seeming as Eucharistic adoration is making profound and crucial affirmations. A lot of popular piety, and I was saying this at the plenary assembly, popular religiosity is all about an affirmation of the body. Because a lot of secular ideologies, the first thing that they deny, and probably the last, is the importance of the body. I often think that the one part of the creed that is most overlooked, and yet is one of the most important, is when we say we believe in the resurrection of the body. Now, popular religiosity is always about the body. If you're on pilgrimage, you've got to walk. And the other thing, too, is, again, I think of the cross and the icon. What was that experience? It was partly a party. People had fun. They enjoyed themselves. You could tell by the looks on their faces. But there was also an intensity and a depth of prayer. So you've got the combination of party and prayer, but that's popular religiosity too. So in all kinds of ways, I think popular religiosity, which can look so simple and even at times perhaps embarrassingly naive, but it's about an affirmation of the flesh, in a way that celebrates the fact that God took flesh once upon a time and is still to be encountered in the flesh. So it's an affirmation of the body.
Warm thanks there to the Archbishop of Canberra and Goulburn, Mark Benedict Coleridge. Meanwhile, moving on in the broadcast, as we all know, the 8th of March marks International Women's Day, a day to celebrate the economic, political and social achievements of women the world over. Women who, as we all know, are at the heart of change in so many nations. Change I once witnessed firsthand in one of the most moving moments in my life as a reporter, when some years ago I went at the invitation of United Nations Children's Fund, in what was a Vatican Radio UNICEF co-production, to a place which at the time was a Hindu kingdom, Nepal, a nation where for the past decade a Maoist insurgency has taken a toll of about 13,000 lives in a conflict which, according to UNICEF, has hampered the delivery of basic services, restricted development, assistance, and caused a breakdown of family and community networks, with the heaviest impacts falling on women and children, consequently on education. All information which, when I read it, made me wonder how those Nepali women and children I met on my fact-finding visit there are faring. So this year, to mark Women's Day, I'd like to share with you an edited version of one of the programmes I then did. Stay tuned. Do you know how to cook rice? Did your husband come to Nepal with you? Do you know how to look after water buffaloes? These were some of the questions the 20 women sitting around a huge table in an enormous empty room that resembled a hangar wanted me to answer. Although the room was dark and gloomy, the women lightened it up with a big splash of colour. There were pinks, blues, reds, and the gleam of gold earrings. All the women sported red tikkas on their foreheads. Some had bright red vermilion in the parting of their hair, the sign of a wedded lady. When I first entered, accompanied by UNICEF field officers and the local women's development officer, Kalpana Bashyal, there had been a pregnant silence. The women needed reassuring before I could ask them anything. Worse still, when I inquired if they wanted to ask me anything, there was an even deadlier silence, a sense of shock. I got the distinct feeling that they'd never been asked something like that before. This was obviously their first contact with an inquisitive outsider. I was convinced I'd said the wrong thing. But no, they were just taken aback and so delighted to express their curiosity, the questions eventually came in volleys. I thought they were roughly my age, but I was mistaken. They were younger, between 20 and 30. Women age fast in Nepal, and formal education is an impossible luxury for women like them. That's why UNICEF sponsors a parallel system that meets the needs of both women and children who would otherwise be forgotten.
With non-formal education, it's both for adults and for the out-of-school children.
American-born Cliff Myers, UNICEF project officer for non-formal education.
Non-formal education isn't a new thing. I think it's really started blooming since the 1970s. But for children, it's something that's really starting to become more of a force throughout the developing world. I mean, we're really expanding the literacy programs. It's 500,000 people this year in Nepal. And next year it will probably be more. And besides the quantity, really focusing on the quality, little by little, not trying to do the whole thing, then I think, if I'm here 3 or 4 years, it'll be worthwhile.
What do you feel is the biggest constraint apart from, obviously, poverty?
Attitude. People not being aware of the power of education, what education is for. Sometimes it gets equated with a government job. Education equals a job. And here in this context, it's to de-link employment and education. The entire population of Nepal, less than 10% have wage-earning jobs. The rest of them are subsistence, trading, farming, migrants, whatever. And to think that primary education will lead you to a wage-earning job is kind of a myth.
In Kathmandu's UNICEF office, I noticed a poster on the wall with the message, "Educate a woman, educate a nation." Here in Talahun, a dusty roadside town almost 100 miles from Kathmandu, I was witnessing how adult literacy classes have affected a few women's lives, and these women certainly had the right attitude. Kies says, one day my 11-year-old daughter begged me to attend night class. Right now we're both being educated. I've learned to express myself, to communicate with others. Mina's 31. Her 15-year-old daughter just got married. She says education counts more than anything else, more than property, husbands. It belongs to you only. You don't have to share it with anyone. Nobody can steal it from you. Little by little, all the women got caught up in the conversation. As they did so, they looked at me with starry-eyed amazement and wonder. I wanted to die because I was illiterate. I can now read the signs indicating offices. I can now recognize banknotes. I can now write my name. I don't have to sign with my thumb any longer. I can get loans from banks. I dream about literacy classes. Most, but not all, of the women sitting there with their exercise books in front of them were literate. They were attending a course that was being held by staff members of a local bank to explain what a credit group is, how to obtain loans, how to benefit from these loans, learn the importance of numbers, all the basics for stepping out of total poverty and becoming productive.
How to come here?
Kalpana has been Tanahu's woman's district officer for the past 10 years. A dark-haired, shortish, lively lady, brimming with energy and joy, she was the first woman in Nepal ever to hold this position. Today, 44 districts out of 75 have a woman's district officer. Kalpana is one of the capable and committed people UNICEF finds so hard to identify. She tells me one of the major problems is the time factor. A husband or a mother-in-law may not always be cooperative. Household duties must be taken care of before anyone dares venture out to attend something as frivolous as an adult literacy class.
Our teachers ask them, "Why you are late in class?" "Oh, sorry, I have to cook and I have to feed our families."
Although the caste system is illegal in Nepal, it still has a great impact on society, and it creates problems for Kalpana as well. After class, ladies of different castes often won't speak to one another.
Caste problem is also one problem in our program. When we managed training, they sit all together. Then when the time is tiffin time, then, "Oh, who is Sarki? Who is Damai? We are Brahmin and we are Chetri. Come here, go there." Then there is very problem for us.
Kalpana tells me she belongs to the elitish Brahmin caste.
What do you do about it?
She describes herself as a simple Brahmin, not a difficult Brahmin. "If my family knew about some of my ventures," she declares, "they wouldn't let me enter the family home anymore."
My father, they don't touch pig, but I carried 4 piglets in a bag. I am very afraid because, "Oh, what is in your bag?" "Oh, here is cats." "Cats? Why you are carrying cats?" "Oh, we have in my home there is a rat, so I carried cat." Then
the projects Kalpana works on are part of UNICEF's community-based programs and also include childcare centers, health programs, drinking water programs, skill training. Kalpana's heart is into providing these poverty-stricken women and their families with the essential skills to becoming self-sufficient. As I was soon to discover, Kalpana's dedication to her students is rewarding. She took me to visit one of them, the best student at her most recent course on goat raising, Leela, who'd won the first prize, naturally a goat. There were eight of us when we climbed back into our UNICEF jeep and drove off along a wide earth track, springs groaning under the weight of it all. At one point we disappeared into a river. Buses were in the shallow waters of its bed while their owners spruced them up, children splashing all around. I thought we would never survive the crossing, but we made it to the opposite bank all right, although a couple of us had to jump out quick into the mud when we began the chugging ascent towards Lila Kumari's house. Despite there being no phones, Lila was standing expectantly on the doorstep of her modest two-story thatched house, built with the bricks her husband had baked himself in the backyard. The youngest of her four sons was rubbing his eyes. He'd picked up an eye infection that seems to be common here. She showed me her riches. A water buffalo she'd got a loan of 7,000 rupees for. Her goats bought at 5,000 rupees each. I've already repeated the loan, she tells me. I noticed a tag on the animal's ear. I couldn't believe it. These animals are insured. Indoors it was dark. There was a smokeless stove in the far corner. She'd been taught to make it herself, and during the following week had built 135 more for her neighbours, charging them 80 rupees each. Gentle Lila is 43. She can now read and write. School is an opportunity. It's my top priority. I never miss a class, she says. I've come a long way. She tells me her story. Her mother died when she was 11 years old. Things are not like they used to be. She attended literacy classes and now her eyes are opened and the children are growing up and she can work hard and be happy. Lila then took me to the back of her house to visit her kitchen garden. It could have been an advertisement for the UNICEF seed distribution scheme to improve quality and variety of food for children. A flourishing mixture of sugarcane, salad, sweet potatoes, lime, ginger, mangoes, sweet-smelling guavas appeared like magic before me. There was rice drying out in an open space. Her husband was working in the extra plot they've managed to rent to grow the black lentils that are the main source of protein in the Nepali diet and part of the staple meal people eat here, dal bhat, which means lentils and rice. She looks at him with pride and says, he doesn't drink or play cards, you know. I admired her pawpaw tree, and she smiled coyly. Pawpaws are supposed to bring bad luck here, but my teacher told me they're good for one's health, so I let my children eat them. She then showed me some guava jelly she'd learnt to make. She held the jar reverently in her hands, looking at it in awe.
Humans have no land, no money, no authority, only they have children.
Kalpana gloated over these self-confident ladies. She had a right to be proud. They owed her everything.
House to house, door to door, women to women, from women's heart. Yes.
Women to women, from women's heart. I began to understand the truth behind the poster in the UNICEF office in Kathmandu. Educate a woman. Educate a nation. You were listening there to a program from My Personal Archive, which was the result of a fact-finding visit to Nepal in what was a Vatican Radio UNICEF co-production. And that brings us up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.vaticanradio.org.
Laudator Jesus Christus.